The Journey of an Astronaut. For some, the idea of blasting off into space is pretty terrifying. But for others, becoming an astronaut is the stuff of dreams and wonder. And it's a dream come true for Jessica Meir, who grew up in Caribou, Maine, and has just been chosen for her first space flight. She'll take off for the International Space Station in September. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me for a conversation with Jessica Meir to learn about her childhood in Maine, what she had to do to become an astronaut, what the training is like, and what she plans to do while she's up in space orbiting the Earth. We'll also get her take on the future of space exploration. Did you ever dream of becoming an astronaut? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Ever since she was a kid growing up in Caribou, Maine, Jessica Meir had her sights on becoming an astronaut. That single-minded passion has paid off as she prepares for her launch in September to the International Space Station. Jessica Meir has been training with NASA since 2013. Her background is in biology, and she studied the physiology of animals in extreme environments. She's also worked for Lockheed Martin's Human Research Facility and has already gone on research flights and served as an aquanaut with NASA. She was just selected last month for her first space flight. And we are fortunate that she is taking time out from training to join us today from the studios at Johnson Space Center in Houston. As always, we want to hear from you. What would you like to ask Jessica Meir? Are you curious about how she's getting ready for her mission? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak with all of you today.
Great. Can you just first share with us how you felt when you heard that you were chosen to fly to the International Space Station? How did they let you know about that?
It's definitely an exciting feeling. You know, it's something that we, as all astronauts in our office, are preparing for all the time when we come here and start training, is, you know, waiting for that first space flight. And so I have been preparing and training really since I started here in 2013, so it'll be almost 6 years now. But that moment really does change when you find out that you have a launch date. And I actually knew for a little bit longer. We're sort of in a unique time right now with the space station program in terms of these new vehicles that are being built by SpaceX and Boeing, and we're getting ready for those first launches. Unfortunately, they've been a little bit delayed, so it's been a little bit complicated in terms of flying up there and getting more seats with the Russians on the Soyuz rocket. So we're kind of in this unique time, which is why it was a little bit of a delayed announcement this time, where it's only 5 months before I launch. It's usually a lot earlier than that. But it really does change everything when you have a launch date associated with it, and you think about, you know, everything that you've been doing and working toward really your whole life, but particularly since you started here at NASA. And I think, though, since we really do so much training all the time, and all these things have really become kind of second nature to everything that we do, that we're always doing it in the training environment. So I think that it's going to be difficult to realize that I'm actually going to the space station and actually blasting off from the surface of the Earth. I think that I probably won't set in until I'm sitting on the rocket.
That'll be quite a setting in. Well, as you can imagine, here in Maine, we're so thrilled that a girl from Caribou is now an astronaut headed for space. So we kind of want to hear a little bit more about your childhood in Maine. What was it like growing up in Caribou?
It was a great place to grow up. I think for me, some of the things that I probably just took for granted back then, I appreciate a lot more now. And first of that is really my connection with nature. I love being outside. I love hiking and being in the forest, really more than anything. That's how I prefer to spend my free time. And of course, there's no lack of trees in Maine in general, and particularly up north. So I think that was something that was probably fostered just naturally from where I grew up. And my mom, as a Swede, has a great connection to nature too. So I think she probably helped foster that along. The other thing that I was talking about recently with someone was the stars. And I remember a lot of times going out either in the backyard or going somewhere where we had a good view of the stars and gazing up and seeing the thick Milky Way. And that was another thing. I didn't realize how fortunate we were, how lucky we were to have that view without a lot of light pollution up there, you know, without any big cities close by. And that was something, you know, I grew up with the stars looking that way. So I didn't really realize that not everybody has that privilege. So maybe that has something to do with leading me to where I am today.
Right. I actually wanted to find out about that because I did hear that you wanted to be an astronaut from a really young age, like 5 years old. Was it the stars, or what was it that appealed to you about that?
Yeah, that's right. My mom tells me I started saying I wanted to be an astronaut when I was 5. And then my first distinct memory of it was when I was in first grade and we were asked to draw a picture of what we wanted to be when we grew up. And I drew a picture of an astronaut in a spacesuit standing on the surface of the moon with a flag, and then pretty much said it ever since then. But there was no particular moment or event or anything that I think really inspired that. I'm not really sure what it was. I think maybe, you know, the shuttle program was very active when I was growing up in the 80s, and it was really highly televised. You know, if you recall, always on the evening news, they would always broadcast the shuttle launch and the shuttle landing. And, you know, that was before the internet, so it was more difficult to have, you know, whatever you had the specific interview or the specific events that were presented to you on the evening news or in the paper. There wasn't as much freedom of choice to kind of follow along. So I think that I was probably influenced a bit by that, and I think also just kind of that connection with nature and exploration in general. That's something that has really dominated throughout my life, whether it was in my extracurricular pursuits or in my previous career as a scientist. I've always been led by that spirit of exploration and kind of going out into places like the Antarctic that fewer people have been to. So I think space is probably just the next natural step for that.
And what did your parents and friends think of your dream of being an astronaut?
They always encouraged it. You know, I think a lot of kids say it growing up, but for me, it was something that I never stopped saying, and it's something that everybody always associated with me. So my childhood friends, for example, I've just been talking with them, all my childhood friends from Caribou, a lot lately. We're hopefully going to all get together this summer when I'm in Maine. It will be so great to see them. But, you know, they think that too. You know, they're just saying, wow, I remember you saying that so distinctly. And that's really from every phase of my life. When I was in college, a friend recently said to me, oh, I remember you had that poster of the moon. And, you know, this was something that you always said. I know during my college graduation from Brown, actually my parents printed out, you know, it was when we had the printer paper for computers on that, you know, with the holes
in
the side.
Yeah, the holes, right.
And they love to print out those banners. They printed out a banner that said, congratulations, space girl.
Oh.
And they held that up when I was marching from Brown. And my college roommate remembers that. She and her family remember that event very well. So it's always just been something that was a part of my life. You know, everybody associated that with me. I don't know that anybody really thought that it would happen. I mean, I didn't necessarily think it would happen either, always knowing that it was such a small chance that it would.
Well, what's interesting is you did make it happen step by step. You mentioned Brown University, you studied biology, and it seems like every choice you made, maybe you can sort of flesh it out, all the steps that you took to reach this point.
Sure, yeah. It was something that I did always try to continue to be involved with no matter what phase of life I was in. So I think the first thing that I did was I attended a Purdue University's space camp before high school. And that was my older sister at the time was at Purdue for graduate school, and she found out that they had a space camp. So I was really excited about that. And I went there for a few weeks in the summer. In college, I did a summer program called the Space Life Sciences Training Program, which is something that the NASA Kennedy Space Center offered. And that was an amazing opportunity. It was 6 weeks where it was fully funded. And we went down to Kennedy Space Center and we worked in the labs and we had training from all kinds of different personnel that worked there. We met with some astronauts. So that was a really amazing opportunity. I was involved while I was at Brown. I was involved in NASA's reduced gravity student flight opportunities. And that was a really amazing program where if you're familiar with NASA's KC-135, the vomit comet. It's been a few different airplanes, but originally back then it was a KC-135. So that's the airplane that flies in a series of parabolas, so it generates about 30-35 seconds of weightlessness each time. And they had a program where, as a student, you could submit an experiment, and if your experiment was selected, then you could come down to NASA to perform the experiment. And we did that, a group of students at Brown, and I did that 1 year, and that was another great opportunity to continue my involvement. But I think the other thing was that I was really pursuing what I was really passionate about in parallel. I love biology. That was always my favorite subject and something that I wanted to do, and I thought I wanted to major in that before college, and I was sure as soon as I took my first Bio 100 class, I was sure that I wanted to do it. And that, you know, some people would say that's not really the most traditional or expected path toward becoming an astronaut. Most people think, oh, you need to be an engineer or a military pilot. But the really interesting thing about the office now is that we are incredibly diverse. We still have a lot of engineers. I would say most people do have degrees in engineering. We have a lot of military pilots. But now there are other scientists of all types. There are medical doctors. So we do have a lot of diversity. As long as you have a degree in any of the STEM fields, so any hard science, technology, engineering, math, you can become an astronaut. So I really like that we have that diversity now. And for me, you know, even if becoming an engineer would have seemed like a more direct path, that wasn't really what I wanted to do. I really wanted to pursue biology. And so I think that's one of the really important things of I try to instill in kids growing up. Make sure you're doing whatever it is you're passionate about, because I do really believe that if you're not truly passionate about it, then you probably won't excel at it. And most importantly, you probably won't be happy doing it. So luckily, I was able to pursue both of those paths kind of in parallel, doing this degree in biology and still making sure I was maintaining whatever presence I could or whatever experience I could with the NASA side as well.
I want to hear a little more about the biology and some of the studies you did with that. But backing up to that vomit comet, did it make you feel sick?
No, it didn't actually. Not everybody gets sick on it. A lot of people do, thus the name. But actually now, when people have been doing it more recently, they use a lot of medication, so anti-motion sickness medications too. So, but no, even back then without medication, I didn't get sick, so I really enjoyed it. It was a really cool experience. You never forget that first time that you enter that first period of weightlessness and your arms kind of lift up and you kind of feel everything inside your body too kind of lifting up. It's a really unforgettable experience. And, you know, of course, those bouts are really short, only about 30 to 35 seconds. So I'm really looking forward to having that maintained sense of microgravity.
It's a little teaser for you, but you knew then that that was for you, huh?
Right, yeah.
So yeah, as far as the bio studies and the research you did on animals, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So during my undergrad, I just did general biology, but as a graduate student at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which is part of UC San Diego, I studied the diving physiology of marine mammals and birds. So I was really intrigued by the work that some of the professors were doing there, looking at elite divers like emperor penguins and elephant seals and trying to understand what is unique about their physiology, about their bodies, that allows them to be such amazing divers. So, for example, an emperor penguin can dive for over 30 minutes on a single breath. Mm-hmm. And they're air-breathing breath-hold divers, just like us, but they can take a breath, go underwater, swim around, catch fish, all stay down there for over 30 minutes. An elephant seal can do that for over 2 hours. So really phenomenal behaviors that these animals exhibit throughout the animal kingdom, and I was really intrigued by that. I wanted to know more about it and to study more about it. So with our lab's work at Scripps, we were going regularly. Every year we would go down to McMurdo Station in the Antarctic to work with the emperor penguins. And we set up a campsite there called the Penguin Ranch. And that was, you know, still up there with one of the most amazing things I've ever done. The method was pioneered by Jerry Koyman. When he was down there in the 60s, he realized, you know, this, what method could I use to try to study these animals, to try to put data recorders on these animals and then get them back? And he looked out on the sheet of ice and he thought, well, if I artificially drilled some holes in the ice and then I brought the animals there and then I let them dive in and out of those holes and there was nowhere else that they could exit, then we could put instruments on and then they could come back to those holes. We could get the instruments off and have a little camp. That's how it became the Penguin Ranch. So we would drill two holes and then we would put a fence up around those holes so that we could deploy our recorders on the animals and then still get the... And then they would be undergoing this natural behavior where they're diving naturally and they're catching fish and they're diving in the sea like they would be. And then we can still get the data back, which of course is the most important part of doing science. So we were putting on time depth recorders to understand more about their diving behavior, how long and how deep they dive. And then the novel part of our study was that we were looking at the partial pressure of oxygen. So we were actually measuring the level of oxygen in the respiratory system and then also in the blood. So we could, this oxygen electrode was inserted into veins and arteries, for example, so we could directly measure the decrease of oxygen throughout the dive and then try to understand what is happening with the overall patterns of oxygen depletion and then how low the level of oxygen goes and that kind of thing. We did the same kind of work with elephant seals in Northern California with a little slightly different study protocol since, of course, we didn't have the ice there. But basically, one of the things that we found that these elite divers can tolerate extremely low levels of oxygen. So at a level where you and I would be unconscious, even a very elite swimmer or diver would be unconscious, they're still functioning normally. So there's still enough oxygen to support their brain activity, to support everything that they do. So they're truly remarkable. They have these adaptations that other animals simply do not have. And then they use that oxygen very effectively throughout the dive. So they decrease their heart rate, they decrease their overall metabolism so that they can be more effective in managing their oxygen stores.
Wow.
After I was studying the diving animals, I was interested in high altitude animals. So that was kind of the next step. You know, they're not holding their breath, but of course they're living or flying at an altitude so high, there is way far less oxygen up there. So I studied the barheaded goose, which is the species of goose that migrates over the Himalayas twice a year. So flying over the tallest mountains on our planet. And that means that they are experiencing oxygen levels only about a half or a third of what we experience here at sea level. So same kind of thing. How are these animals adapted to do that, to do this remarkable behavior? And when the barheaded geese are doing their migration, their northward migration, they're doing that from sea level and then crossing the mountains in only about 7 to 8 hours. So you can imagine, you know, an elite climber that wants to conquer Everest, they have to spend a very long period of time adapting as they go, you know, adapting at base camp and taking it very slowly so that their bodies adapt to that environment. But somehow the birds are able to do it without that acclimation and adaptation period. So really remarkable behavior. So what we were doing, we decided to fly barheaded geese in a wind tunnel because we wanted to be able to measure several of these physiological parameters at the same time. So we needed a really controlled environment to do that. So I actually became Mother Goose, where I imprinted geese. I was with them from the time they hatched, and the first thing that they saw was me, and so they truly thought that I was their mom.
Oh,
and
that's
that
so
way,
cute.
Yeah, it was a really amazing experience. Definitely unforgettable, and makes for some great pictures, of course, too. But they followed me everywhere I went, and you know they didn't want to be without me, but the point scientifically was that then they would be comfortable with me. So they would be comfortable in that setting in the wind tunnel, and then we would be measuring a true physiological response instead of measuring something like a fear response, you know, with a wild animal if you tried to bring a wild animal into that setting. So this was work that I did for my postdoc at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and we were successful in training the birds and getting data and flying them in the wind tunnel, and that was, I think, probably more difficult than getting this job was teaching those birds to fly in the wind tunnel.
Wow. Well, you certainly make science sound fun, and I can see how that all led to where you are today. We do need to take a quick break now, but first, a related note. Maine Public will host two screenings of the PBS film Chasing the Moon about the space race, moderated by our own Erwin Gratz. The first will be at the Southworth Planetarium in Portland on June 19th, and the second will be at Jordan Planetarium in Orono on June 26th. You can get more information at mainepublic.org. And now for a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine calling possible, as do Downeast Acadia, where Maine is for the birds, inviting you to explore Acadia to Cobscook, with three birding festivals, more truemaine.net. And the Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974, joebornstein.com.
On the next Fresh Air, part two of our interview with Howard Stern, and we listen back to my interview with Doris Day. She died Monday at the age of 97. She had such a beautiful voice. Join us.
I remember you. You're the one who made my dreams come true.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is proud to be a media sponsor of the second Abbey Museum Indian Market this weekend, Friday through Sunday, in downtown Bar Harbor. The market, which is free and open to the public, features Native American artists and performers from nations across the U.S. and Canada. For details on the market, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, astronaut Jessica Meir joins me from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. And joining us on the line now is Vaughn McLaughlin. He is Director of Music for Caribou Schools. Hi, Mr. McLaughlin. Thank you for calling in.
Hi.
I understand you had Jessica Meir as a band student years ago at Caribou High School. What do you want to talk about as far as Jessica's role as a student back then?
Well, hi, Jess. Can you hear me?
Hello.
No?
I can. I can hear you.
I had Jess all the way through middle and high school. She was a dedicated music student while she was here in Caribou, as well as a science student and everything else that she studied. She was one of those kids that's really driven. She played flute in our concert band, played saxophone in the jazz ensembles, and if I needed a bass drummer in marching band, she picked that up as well. She was an accomplished musician, played in my big bands later in life, and Jess also babysat my kids when I had my younger ones. She used to come to the house and played in the big band in the summertime, and she was a fabulous student. Matter of fact, I see her name along with the other kids in her class every day. They bought a music stand when I was when they graduated from high school in 95. And she's a real inspiration to all the kids here in Caribou. We talked about it in band rehearsal today just before I called in. I'm sure they're all sitting on the radio listening right now.
Is there anything you want to ask Jessica?
Well,
yeah, thanks so much. I had one comment. I wanted him to know that I did fly my piccolo up there. So it's actually up there already waiting for me. I wanted to fly a flute, but it was a little bit too big. So the piccolo's up there. I'm not sure I should have told him that, because now I'm really going to have to deliver.
Is there anything different about playing a piccolo when you're in space?
It shouldn't be on the space station since we're pressurized in there. It's kind of like playing it anywhere else, but we'll see what happens.
Oh, that's fabulous. I don't know that we had talked about that a while ago. I have to tell you a story about Jess. When she was younger, still in high school or maybe just out of high school, I listened to her talk about her experiment with the geese. She took a trip to Florida, and she's never had any fear, and decided they would do that whole parasailing thing behind a boat. And got up in the air, and the rope snapped, and landed on, for better or worse, I guess, an island someplace, and came down and worked like a bungee cord and kind of caught her before she hit the ground completely. I don't ever remember her talking about that in a fearful way.
That was your first space flight, Jessica?
Yeah, it was funny. My mom remembers that story well. And when we were in the boat after I had landed on this uninhabited island, the people that operated the outfit were trying to make conversation, like, oh, what does she want to be when she grows up? And my mom said, she wants to be an astronaut, so this is great training. So luckily things turned out well that day.
Well, yeah. Go ahead, Mr. McLaughlin.
We're real proud of you. We'll be looking into the night sky and waving as you fly by. I know my own kids, so we look for the space station, and we'll be thinking of you every day while you're up there.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. That was Vaughn McLaughlin, who directs the music program for the Caribou School Department. So, Jessica, were you a thrill seeker as a kid?
I don't know if I would have said I was a thrill seeker, but I definitely like to do really active, exciting things. I think my mom sort of just got used to that kind of behavior, especially after high school, where I wanted to get into things like scuba diving and skydiving and flying lessons and that kind of thing. So then it became even more expected.
Okay. I wanted to find out more about training. You're right in the heat of training right now. What does that mean? What do you do, and how intense is it?
Yeah, so we are always training as astronauts, really from day one when we start our careers here. So when we first arrived, we had 2 years of what we call astronaut candidate training. So that's kind of like basic training for astronauts, everything from flight training to how to use the spacesuit, how to fly the robotic arm on the space station, Russian language training, since everybody on the space station has to speak both English and Russian, and then training about all the different space station systems, so the electrical system, the thermal control system, the life support system, that kind of thing. Then we have a lot of other things interspersed in there, leadership training, analog type training where we live in other extreme environments underwater or in a cave. I had the chance to do both of those things, which were really amazing. And then we also work normal jobs here at Johnson Space Center before we get our first flight assignment, where we'll work in mission control, we'll be a representative on a certain board, and we take turns doing different jobs in that capacity. Then when we do have our first flight assignment, we enter what's called mission-specific training. So it still has elements of all of the other stuff that we've done in the past. Of course, we have to maintain our proficiency in how to use the spacesuit, how to fly the robotic arm, how to understand how to operate all of the different space station systems and do maintenance, because, of course, things are breaking a lot up there, especially now that the space station's getting older. We have to do routine maintenance, and then we have to be ready to repair and replace things as they go. You know, if we need to change a light bulb or fix the toilet, we can't call a plumber or an electrician. We have to be able to do all that ourselves. So all of that stuff continues during our mission-specific training. But the thing that's unique now for me, and this is something that I started actually last January, so January of 2018, I started training in Russia. And so that is because I'm going to be flying up on the Soyuz rocket, the Russians' rocket and spacecraft. That is all specific toward learning how to fly in the spacecraft itself. So everything involved during all the phases of launch and rendezvous and then landing as well. So that most of my last year was really spent over there in Russia. I am going to be the co-pilot of the Soyuz. So there are three people in each Soyuz. There's the Russian commander. Then there's a left-seater who is basically the co-pilot helping the commander out with everything. And then there's the right-seater as well. And the right-seater is often another astronaut. And so they have functions that are important and contribute to the crew as well. But most of the tasks are managed between the commander and the left seat. So it really kind of depends on what else is happening with the program, where you fall on those. I actually am going to be the co-pilot in the left seat. So I have a lot more training over there than I would if I were in the right seat, which is why I spent most of last year over there. But I love it. I mean, it's such an amazing opportunity. You know, my background is not even as a test pilot. And now here I am learning how to co-pilot this spacecraft and doing that in Russian. So it's quite a challenge, but it's a lot of fun.
And how is your Russian? Are you going to be speaking Russian all the way through that part of this the mission?
Yeah, so all of our training in Russia is in Russian. So we do have support of interpreters and that kind of thing that we can use as we need. But, you know, when you're going through all of the simulations and all the flight phases, it's all done in Russian. So, yeah, I really like studying foreign languages. You know, maybe it was since I grew up with my parents that were both from other countries, but that's something that I've really enjoyed doing. So, of course, my Russian could always be better, but it's not bad. It's enough to get by and do what I need to do for now.
I have a question from a colleague. Does she know how to say caribou in Russian?
Well, names are usually pretty similar, so it would probably just sound a little bit more Russian, like caribou, or I don't know.
Like you're saying it with an accent, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. So for the training, what sort of physical condition do you need to be to start with when you finish? It just seems like physically, it's so demanding.
Yeah, as astronauts, we do have a lot of medical requirements, and that's something that begins even before we're selected. So there are a lot of medical tests that go on even before we're selected that are really kind of rule out criteria, just because, you know, we want to make sure that we have a healthy population. We're invested, the country really is investing so much in us, in money and resources, of course, and we want to make sure that we, you know, aren't going to develop some kind of condition that would prevent us from doing our job and from going to space. So I would say the first big requirement is getting through all of those pre-flight, the pre-selection criteria. And then afterward, when we get here, you know, being fit is, of course, really important, I think, for our job. You know, it's important on a daily basis when we're on the ground, when we're doing things like if, for example, we landed in an aircraft somewhere, we do a lot of flight training in the NASA T-38 jets. So if we were in a situation where we had to quickly get out of the jet in order to save our lives, obviously you need to be strong and fit in order to do that. And you know, I think we're pretty fortunate that we have this job where going to the gym is an encouraged part of our day. I think really should be for all professions, but unfortunately it doesn't work out that way. But it certainly is something that's really important for us. It's even more important when we are in space, since without the constant loading on our bones and our muscles that we experience, even when the two of us are sitting down in a chair and not exercising, we're constantly being loaded by the constant force of gravity. So as soon as you go into space, your bones actually will start leaching calcium, and you'll start experiencing a loss of bone density, and your muscles will start atrophying because you're just not using them in the same way that they're used to throughout our entire lives, throughout really our whole evolution as humans. So in order to prevent that from having very serious consequences, we need to load the bones and muscles, and we do that by exercising in space. We actually have 2 hours of our timeline each day, 6 days a week, timelined for exercise. We have a treadmill, a bicycle, and then also in the resistive device system, so a weightlifting system called ARED, so that we can keep our bones and muscles healthy. And really, now we have such great results with this amazing hardware that we have up there that we are bringing astronauts back that are maintaining their bone density and muscle mass. So really important for us post-flight. Will also be very important for us when we're ready to go back to the moon and go to Mars. We send people to Mars, and if it takes 6 to 9 months to get there, of course, they still need to be able to walk around when they get to the surface. So these are really important things for us as for our individual health, but also for the future of space exploration.
It would seem to me that another thing you need to be able to do is just simply get along well with people, because you're going to be in such close quarters with people day in and day out. So are you judged when they're selecting you? Are you judged on how well you get along with others, or your personalities that go into the selection process?
Yeah, that is a very important part of the selection process now, more so even than it used to be, since right now we are primarily flying, really only flying these long duration missions. So our typical mission on the space station is 6 months. We've had some missions longer than that, as you've probably heard. And so it's very important to, you know, if you're thinking about going up there with five people, living only six people up there for a long period of time like that, just like you said, you know, you want to go up there with people that are enjoyable to be around. So I kind of look at it, we have a buzzword for it now at NASA called expeditionary skills, but really it's just how to play nicely with others. It's the same kind of thing that that parents teach their kids every day. And I think it is really that simple, but it's something that, you know, we don't always think about in all the things that we do. We do select people with that in mind now. So it doesn't necessarily matter if you're a hotshot pilot or that you're the best at whatever you do. If you're not also a good person who people like being around, you probably not going to get selected to be an astronaut anymore. We also foster those skills and have a lot of training objectives as astronauts built around that skill set. So, for example, we'll have leadership and followership courses and exercises so that we start understanding more about ourselves. We go on NOLS leadership trips. So my classmates and I did a 10-day hiking trip in the Wind River Range in Wyoming, which was an amazing experience. We learned a lot from the NOLS crew. We also do what's called analog training, and that has really been one of my favorite things that I've done since this job. And that is when, you know, if you're trying to train for these types of environments or replicate what it's like to be in space, how do you do that? You can't replicate everything. But what we try to do is find an environment that is a little bit hostile, a little bit isolated, somewhere where you're living maybe in a close, confined environment with a small group of people. So we have two primary analogs right now at NASA that we participate in as astronauts. One is called NEMO, the NASA Extreme Environment Mission Operations. That's an underwater mission in the underwater habitat called Aquarius, which is off of Key Largo in Florida. That was something that I actually was fortunate enough to be a crew member in way before I was an astronaut. Back in 2002, I did that when I was here working as a scientist. And I did that with two astronauts and a flight director, and that was a really amazing experience living underwater full-time, kind of being on the reverse side of the aquarium. And much more recently, in 2016, I did the other analog called CAVES, and that is an analog that's run by the European Space Agency, where we actually go live in a cave in Sardinia for about 6 days. So in that situation, we went over to Italy for training for about 10 days because it's really technical caving. It is, you know, you are sometimes rappelling down a 25 meter shaft. Sometimes you're squeezing through a tiny, tiny orifice that looks like you couldn't even fit through. And you're wearing a harness and a technical caving system the whole time, kind of similar to rock climbing equipment, but a little bit different. So we had a lot of training before that. And then we went into the cave. And this was with a crew of five other people, so the same size that I will have on the space station. There was one other NASA astronaut, there was a Spanish astronaut, a Japanese astronaut, a Russian cosmonaut, and even a Chinese taikonaut on my crew. We went into this cave and then we didn't come out until 6 days later. And it was really, I think, the most incredible experience that I've had thus far. This is not just an ordinary cave. It's not like they're putting us into a small room and we're just sitting there for 6 days. This cave is a network of different channels underground, 25 kilometers of different branches and paths. So we actually went down there and set up a campsite, and then we would make daily excursions every day where we had scientific objectives, just like we do in space. We had mission objectives. We had different roles and different functions, and we were even doing some real exploration type activities where we were mapping the cave using laser distance measurements. And so really this would be similar to when we go to Mars or go somewhere new, when we're really truly exploring something new like that. And it was an amazing test of all of those expeditionary skills, because there was real risk and real mental and physical stress involved. And that's really when you bring out all those kinds of behaviors of your own strengths and weaknesses and all of that, and how you react. And that's really important to understanding how to take care of yourself and really how to take care of the other people on your team. And it was, I would say that was just truly exceptional. This cave was unlike anything I'd ever seen. I had no idea that there was anything on the surface of the Earth like this.
It's like going to another planet.
Absolutely.
On Earth. Yeah. Well, we have to take another quick break right now. So when we come back, more of your questions and comments. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine's credit unions, dedicated to making your money go further so you get ahead faster. Details at MaineCreditUnions.org. And Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at EvergreenYourHome.com.
On the next Speaking in Maine, the human rights crisis in Mexico. Origins, impacts, opportunities.
I have heard stories here at Maine of brave women from Central America who came here so they can give a better life to their children.
Maria Luisa Aguilar Rodriguez is a Mexican human rights advocate. She spoke at the University of Maine School of Law's Justice for Women lecture in Portland. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Wednesday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
After Maine Calling, coming up shortly here on Maine Public Radio.
On January 24, 1975, jazz pianist Keith Jarrett reluctantly agreed to play a concert on a broken piano.
It was a disaster. It was supposed to be a disaster.
But once he started playing,
it's magic. Within moments, it's apparent that he is producing something astonishing.
Jumpstarting creativity in ways that might surprise you. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us tonight at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, I am speaking with astronaut Jessica Meir. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-332-3600. 399-3566. And Jessica, we have an email from Mary. She wants to know, who inspired Jessica to follow her dream? Did she have a favorite teacher in Caribou who inspired her, or who?
Yeah, I think that I was very fortunate to have a lot of amazing mentors throughout my life. First of all, starting with my parents and my family. I'm the youngest of five kids, so all my older siblings, I had a lot to live up to and a lot of people I wanted to emulate. And a lot of science teachers as well, even growing up in Caribou. I remember Mrs. Thibodeau, biology teacher, and also Mr. Thibodeau. He would show us George Page's Nature every week in science class, and that was something I always looked forward to. That continued really all throughout my life in college, and then especially in graduate school, my PhD advisor, Paul Ponganis, and then my postdoc advisor, Bill Milsom at UBC. I was very, very lucky to have these people that were, they were amazing scientists. They were at the top of their field, but at the same time, they were really just exceptional humans. They were people that cared about other people, that cared about me, not just as a scientist and professionally, but also as a person. So those were the kind of people that it was really a lot of luck involved in those. I didn't even know enough to try and seek them out. I think I just ended up being really lucky. And I try to give people that advice now, to try to seek out those mentors that you think will be good ones to you, because it is very, very important to everything that you'll do. And then also to try and be a good mentor to other people, because no matter what phase of life you're at, there's always somebody else that's a little bit early on at an earlier phase than you are.
Okay, you talked a little bit about the training and about the launch, but once you reach the International Space Station, what will you be doing?
So when I get to the space station, I will be doing a whole range of activities, ranging from all kinds of different science. So it really is, the space station is a national lab where we are conducting experiments ranging from how physiology and medicine affect the human body. So basically how spaceflight and microgravity affect the human body, all kinds of physiology and medical experiments. We do material science experiments, combustion experiments. There's a facility dedicated toward combustion in space, because even flames burn differently in space. So really any type of science, you name it, chemistry, physics, biology, biotechnology, it is happening on the space station. And, you know, that's really because the one big variable that's being removed, this variable of gravity that's always been there, that's always been present in every scientific system, is suddenly removed. So you can imagine that there might be some really big ramifications or results from that. But just because I'm a scientist doesn't mean that I'm up there doing science all the time. I will also be doing maintenance. I will be, like I said, changing light bulbs, fixing the toilet, making sure everything on the space station is operating correctly. I'll be going for spacewalks to repair and replace things on outside of the space station. I'll be operating the Canadarm, the robotic arm built by the Canadian Space Agency. I will be helping as an operator with other experiments for the other crew members that are up there. We will be doing outreach activities and, you know, talking to school kids, just that kind of thing, same things that we do on the ground. So what I really like about the job is the same thing as down here. We do something different every day. You know, you're not just stuck at a desk every day doing the same thing. It's very active and very diverse.
Is there any aspect of that that you're looking forward to the most?
As a scientist, of course, the science is really appealing to me, and I'm really excited to be able to contribute to that data set for all the scientists on the ground. But aside from that, spacewalk is really the one thing that I always dreamed about, and so that is something that I'm really looking forward to. You know, we never know for sure what's going to happen with the schedule and stuff, so there are a lot of factors that will have to line up correctly for that to happen, but given the current plan, I will be doing several spacewalks as well, so I'm really looking forward to that.
And for that, that's where you really have that big major spacesuit on. How onerous is that?
It is a bear for sure, but interestingly, it's more so a bear on the ground. Now, you know, we do all of the training for that in the neutral buoyancy lab, the big pool that we have here on the space station, that we have here on the ground at the Johnson Space Center. And when you're in that spacesuit, you weigh over 400 pounds, and it's pressurized, so your body is in kind of this awkward position, and every movement is like squeezing an exercise ball kind of thing. So of course, you're still working in a pressurized suit when you're up in space. So you have that aspect that's similar. But without the mass in weightlessness, it's a lot easier to handle in terms of the things that, even though we're underwater in the pool and they try to emulate and simulate all those aspects of weightlessness, there's still gravity, of course, in the pool. So you don't have an exact replica of what it will be like in space.
Wow. Well, wait, I hope you do get to go on one of those spacewalks. That's very cool. We have an email from Bob. He says, as a pilot, I remember wanting to fly the first time I saw an airplane live. It was the Blue Angels at Weymouth, Mass. Naval Air Station. Congrats on hitting your goal and safe flight. And we have a comment from Sandra. She wants to know, do you have any space food preferences?
I do, actually. The space food menu is really quite diverse now. We have a whole lab here, a whole food lab at NASA in the Johnson Space Center, and they are always developing new menu items. So a lot of the new things that they're developing are actually really, really good, and it's a lot more similar to the way that I eat. There's a Turkish fish stew, and there's an Indian fish curry. There's kale. There's a mango salad. There are Brussels sprouts and beets, all these things that I actually really like. So I'm excited about the diversity of food. We also get some Russian food, and the Russian space food is also very delicious.
Is this all the kind you rehydrate, like the little astronaut ice cream you can buy at the store?
Yeah, that ice cream is not exactly like the food we eat, but some of the food that we eat is rehydrated, so it'll be in a little pouch and it's been completely dehydrated, and you go over to the water station and then you inject the needle into it and you just fill it with hot or cold water and then you let it rehydrate. Some of it is just thermostabilized, so basically just like a canning process. So we use pouches instead of cans here at NASA, but it's the same kind of thing like opening a can of tuna. We have all those kind of food products as well.
Okay, Joseph on Facebook says, fun fact, the space station orbits the Earth at about 250 miles, which means Caribou native Jessica Meir will be closer to home when she's flying over on the space station than she would if she were visiting a friend in Portland, Maine, 300 miles south of Caribou. It's a big state. Does that sound about right?
That does sound about right, yeah. I think people outside of Maine don't realize how big it really is.
And review for us, what exactly does the space station do? It's orbiting the Earth. Is it 90 minutes or something like that?
That's right. The International Space Station, that was the correct, the altitude of the orbit, it's about 250 miles above us. And at that altitude, we are going around the entire planet every 90 minutes. So we have multiple sunrises and sunsets. And then since the orbit is at an inclination, and then also the Earth is spinning underneath us, we don't necessarily always pass over the same spots on the Earth. So there's a great resource. There are a bunch of different apps, actually. There's one called Spot the Station that you can download on your smartphone, and you can get the prediction for when you would see a space station pass wherever you live. Some of them are better than others. You know, obviously, if it's at a 90-degree inclination, meaning it's right above your head, then it's easier to see because things like trees and buildings are not in the way, and obviously you need a clear sky. But I really encourage everybody to go out there and watch. It's really cool to see. You know, it looks like a track of any other satellite if you've seen a satellite going over, but it's much, much, much brighter because it has those solar arrays reflecting all the sunlight.
How cool. Is there anything you're not looking forward to? Have you talked to any of the more experienced astronauts who have either cautioned you about dangers or what to watch out for?
I think I'm looking forward to all of it. You know, I think people ask a lot, what will you miss? And I think that I definitely will miss nature. You know, I love being outside. I love trees and fresh air. And so obviously you don't get any of that. Some people describe it as a bit of an irony because you're looking down on from the most beautiful view of all of the different climate zones and the oceans and the mountains and the forests, but you can't touch or be immersed in any of it. So I think that I will miss that. And, you know, some of the everyday life type of activities do take a little bit of getting used to. You know, we don't have running water, so we don't have a real shower. I think you'll really start missing and you'll look forward to getting a real shower again. Going to the bathroom, of course, is a lot more challenging in microgravity than it is down here. So hopefully all that stuff I'll adapt to quite quickly.
And the danger, that doesn't concern you. This is something you want to do, so...
Yeah,
scared.
Absolutely. No, I mean, the training that we receive down here on the ground prepares us for all of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Margie calling from Jonesboro. Hi, Margie, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just wondering two things. One, would she go to Mars? They say like 2030 they're supposed to send someone. Would she go? I mean, that's really heavy.
Yeah, is there a plan for that? And what do you think? Yes.
Yeah, so the first step, you know, if you might have heard in the news most recently, is that we do say that we are going to land and have boots on the ground on the moon by 2024. So I hope that we can make that date. But I think regardless of when it happens, the good thing is that we are on that trajectory and we are making the steps required to get there. And then beyond that will be Mars. You know, we have been planning that at NASA for a while, that eventually we will send humans to Mars. I'm not sure exactly when that will happen, if it will be during my career or not. I hope it does happen, at least in my lifetime. But I would definitely go. You know, I think once NASA develops a plan to bring astronauts there and then bring them home again safely, I'll know that it's a good plan when NASA finally has that ready, and I would absolutely go.
Great. Thanks, Margie. And, you know, my dad worked for NASA back in the day, when the early days of NASA, and the space race, he always talks about, it was very much an issue of national pride. And it seems like NASA is having another resurgence now with the other competition from other countries. Do you feel like that's sort of pushing space exploration?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, whatever it is that is stimulating it, I think we're at a time where we do need to work together with commercial partners, with our international agencies as well. And part of that is just reality. You know, when we went to the moon, the Apollo budget was 4%, about 4% of our GDP. Now the entire NASA budget is, I think, about 0.04%. So we're just not operating with the same kind of resources that we were back then. So if we want to be able to go back to the moon, if we want to be able to do something great like go to Mars, then we are going to have to work with other commercial partners and with our international agencies, just like we're doing right now on the International Space Station. And that part is what makes it so appealing to me. I think it's amazing what we can do when we're working together on something so incredible like this as spaceflight and as something like a space station. We're doing that with our Russian partners, our Japanese, European, and Canadian colleagues. And despite any difficult political situations on the ground, we are still able to do that. And I think that really says something.
Okay, we have a little bit of time. Christopher is calling from Camden. Hi, Christopher, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask Jessica?
Well, Jessica, I was chief mate on Alyssa down in Galveston when we did our 2 weeks of day sails. Were you on board for one of the day sails?
No, I haven't. Some of my classmates, actually, my classmate Christina, who's on the space station right now, did a rigorous program on Alyssa that was part of kind of like one of these analog training environments that I was describing. It's a new one that we're starting to participate in. So unfortunately, I haven't been on it yet, but hopefully I will in the future.
Great. Thanks for calling, Christopher. So you mentioned earlier you're bringing a piccolo up. Are there any other special little items that you're going to bring with you?
We're allowed to fly really a very small allocation of personal effects, you know, things that we want to fly for ourselves or fly for other people, or official items even that we want to fly for a university or an institution or a group that's really important to us. So I have several mementos that are up there already waiting for me, and hopefully I'll be able to get some good pictures of them up there, things for, you know, the universities that I attended and that kind of thing. Personally, yeah, you mentioned the piccolo, and I'm hoping to still bring with me on the Soyuz my panda bear that I've had, my stuffed panda that I've had since I was 5 years old. So that'll be a personal thing. And a few other things as well.
Great. And when you're up there, are you able to communicate readily back to Earth?
Yeah, we are. Since we mentioned, you know, the space station is only 250 miles away, and using a network of satellites that we use for regular communications, telecommunications on the ground as well, we have a lot of communications coverage. So we will be in near constant communication contact with the Mission Control Center. And we can even make calls. So I could pick up what we call the IP phone. So it's basically just using internet protocol, kind of like how Skype operates. And I can call any phone that I want to, you know, if we have the right satellite coverage. And then we do have some video, face-to-face video opportunities too with our family members and loved ones. So it is possible to still maintain contact with our friends and family while we're up there.
Well, good. We're hoping that we can get you to call Maine Public Radio from space and we can hear from you.
Yeah, that would be great. I hope it works out.
Great. Well, thanks so much for talking with us, Jessica. That's Jessica Meir. She's an astronaut with NASA, and she's from Caribou, and she was recently selected to fly to the International Space Station. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Isaac Merson took your calls, and you can find past editions of Maine Calling by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.